So, once again, what I told you at the end of the last lecture was something extremely weird, which is that if you study the cross-sections for E plus E minus going to any hadrons, 2 pions, 3 pions, 17 pions, kaons, protons, what you find for that cross-section, and let's just say it's convenient to divide that cross-section by the cross-section for producing mu plus mu minus in E plus E minus annihilation. As a function of energy, the first thing you find is that at the energy of 2m pi, this first process turns on rather slowly. It actually has a big resonance called the rho resonance, rho and omega. There's another resonance called the phi, which I told you about at about 1 GeV. All these particles with the quantum numbers of spin 1 and, so these quantum numbers with the spin 1 and charge conjugation odd are produced as resonances in this process. But then eventually what happens is there are lots of resonances. They overlap. And the total cross-section, the sum of all these things, settles down to a number that's approximately a constant. And the constant is a little larger than 2, which is equal to 3 times the sum of the squares of the quark charges that we found in some other way. And then what happens is that at an energy of 3.1 GeV, there's another giant resonance. And as I said, at 3.7, another one. And then some complicated threshold structure. And then again, this settles down at a number that is a little higher than the number 3 1/3, which you would get by adding one more 2/3 charged quark to this. And then at 10 GeV, there's another set of resonances. And above that, you settle down to a number that's rather close to 3 2/3. It's not exactly equal to that. And we'll have to make a theory of the difference. In fact, I'll presumably tell you a little about the theory of the difference between the actual value and these very simple numbers next week. But for now, well within 5%, these numbers are in agreement. And the events in these regions have the following two striking properties. That, first of all, the events, and this becomes more and more obvious when you go to high energy, have the character that they look like two bundles of tracks like that. In high energy physics, we call these jets. And secondly, that if you assign a direction to the jets, the angular distribution of that direction is well approximated by 1 plus cosine squared theta, which is, you remember, the QED distribution for producing elementary massless spin a half fermions. So somehow the strong interactions act. Because we don't see quarks in the final state. We see pions, kaons, protons. But nevertheless, somehow this reaction, in terms of the rate and in terms of the overall momentum flow, totally ignores the strong interactions. And all of those quantities can be computed on the basis of a quark theory that basically leaves out the strong interactions completely. Maybe I should say, up to this question of whether this is the exact right number or whether you should correct it by 5% or so. So this is extremely bizarre. But nevertheless, it's a hint. And so what I'd like to do in this lecture is to plunge on into the theory of strong interactions and see if we can gather some more hints of this type. So maybe I should ask. Oh, and maybe I should say one more thing. The structure of these jets, these bundles of particles, is actually a quite interesting topic. And I'm going to have a lecture on that next week, next Tuesday. So we'll go into that as well. But for the moment, I'd like you to think of this as a single object, which is, if you like, the way the quark is actually reflected in an experiment. OK, are there any questions about that before I go on? OK, so now what I'd like to do is to discuss another kind of experiment, which occurred earlier, and which gave other hints at this kind of structure. And that experiment is electron scattering on a proton. Actually, this is a part of my culture, because electron scattering on a proton is the first thing that made the lab where I am, SLAC, very famous. And I think I didn't resist including as the first slide in today's batch a photograph of the famous SLAC MIT deep inelastic scattering experiment. When I was a graduate student, I visited SLAC and I got to see this thing. It's quite interesting. I mean, the basic idea of the experiment is you use the 3 kilometer long linear accelerator at SLAC to produce an electron beam, which at that time had an energy of 17 GeV. And you shoot that electron beam at a liquid hydrogen target. And then you try and analyze what comes out. Now, in general, the electron will come out. And then either the proton will come out, or the proton plus some pions. That is to say, some disrupted parts of the proton. And you can imagine how this reaction works. You have a scattering. Here's the proton. The first thing you can have is elastic scattering. An elastic scattering of an electron from a proton actually has a long history at Stanford. It was studied in the 1950s by Hofstadter. Actually, Hofstadter won the Nobel Prize for those measurements. Among other things, Hofstadter measured the size, not only the size of a nucleus, but the distribution of matter in the nucleus by doing these experiments. When you go to higher energy, so this is electron-proton scattering. When you go to higher energy, as you can imagine, you can excite the delta resonance. You can excite higher nucleon resonances. And you get some data of which I actually have an example also in the figures. It's page 3 of the PDF. You can see in those figures, W is the energy transferred to the proton. As a function of that energy, you see prominent resonances that correspond to excited states of this. Let me just take this out so I can refer to it. You see prominent resonances which correspond to the various excited states of the proton, which, as we now understand it, is a bound state of 3 quarks. Of course, this structure is extremely complex. The very interesting innovation of the people who did the experiment I'm going to describe now is to make a claim analogous to the one that I made over here. That is to say, let's just ignore what's going on this side and sum these things all up together and only look at what's going on with the electron. So then the way the experiment is laid out, there's a spectrometer that measures the energy and momentum of the electron. The spectrometer is actually on railroad tracks, so you can rotate it to different angles. You guys have all done this experiment, you know, with a radioactive source and a piece of lead, and you put some photomultiplier tube behind it, and you rotate that around, and you measure the Compton cross-section. How many of you did that in your laboratory? Yeah. So this looks exactly like that, except the size of it is the size of this building. And so in that experiment, the outcome was quite unexpected and somewhat bizarre. A lot of people thought that there was, if you raised the energy very high and you looked at very inelastic processes with lots of particle production, there wouldn't be any cross-section there. But there is one, and it has an interesting description, which I'm now going to lay out for you. Okay, now the description that I'm going to use is modeled on the phenomenon that we had here. This thing is all 1970s and 1980s. This is 1967, so I'm a little ahistorical here. But nevertheless, let's try and make a description of this process modeled on what we learned from E plus E minus annihilation. So that model would be something like this. Let me first write some kinematics for this process, and then we'll try and analyze this in more detail. So the electron comes in, it has a momentum k, it scatters, this is a virtual photon exchange. This momentum here is called q, and this momentum is k prime. So k is equal to k prime plus q. Q is a necessarily a space-like momentum, and it's canonical to write q squared equals minus q squared, defining this quantity capital Q. Okay, the proton comes in with momentum p, and the momentum over here is p plus q. Now what I'd like you to notice is that if you measure the energy and momentum of the outgoing electron, you actually know q as a 4-vector. And my claim is that's all you have to know to analyze this data. It's a somewhat non-trivial claim, but you'll see how it works. And so we'll try and do as much as we can just using the 4-vector, the dependence of things on the 4-vector components of q without worrying about the details of the final state. Okay. So how can we proceed? Well, if you really take the stuff that I'm erasing now extremely seriously, what you would say is the basic thing that's going on is electron quark scattering, and maybe another miracle will occur where when we analyze the scattering of an electron from a proton, which you remember is a strongly interacting bound state of quarks, nevertheless, when we analyze the scattering of an electron from a proton, we can totally ignore the strong interactions and just think about the electron scattering from quarks. So, well, it's stupid, but it's easy. So let's do it. So the first thing I want to do is to calculate the differential cross-section for electron scattering from a quark. So that's this diagram here. Let me call this momentum little p. This is actually a pretty easy calculation because I basically did all the work last time. So last time I derived for you the following formulae. The matrix element for E plus E minus E plus left right going to Q left Q bar right is equal to I E squared, the charge of the quark. And then you remember what we got was the expression minus 2, was there 2 there? Yes, minus 2 U over S, where U is the Mandelstam invariant, which this is K prime, and this is P prime. U is the Mandelstam invariant K minus P prime, or K prime minus P. And for the, sorry, I'm all confused. This is the process that I'm talking about now. So this had P coming in here, P bar, K, and K bar. And U was equal to K bar minus P squared. T was equal to K minus P squared. And remember, S is the center of mass energy, P plus P bar squared. And then I derive for you also the formula E minus left, E plus right, going to Q right, Q left, so I switch the helicities here, is equal to minus 2i e squared qf t over s. And so if you evaluate it in the kinematics here, this quantity is proportional to 1 plus cosine theta, so it's a forward peak distribution as required by angular momentum. And this is 1 minus cosine theta, it's a backward peak distribution. Now, I also explained to you the principle of crossing symmetry. That is, when we've computed some amplitude from a Feynman diagram, if we turn the Feynman diagram on its side, so here I just turn the Feynman diagram over and I get this one, then the answer for the amplitude is actually the same, except that you have to reassign the momenta appropriately. And so given these answers, I can immediately write down the amplitudes that come from this diagram. Now, I should have said you have to be a little careful about this. If you have the sum over polarizations, this is totally straightforward. If you're working with helicity states, you have to be very careful because helicity states cross in a quite non-trivial way for massive particles. However, for massless particles, the helicity is a definite, well-defined Lorentz invariant quantity. And so then you can just cross the helicity amplitudes in a very simple way. And so now from these results, let me just write down the answers for this process. So I am E minus Q OK, so first of all, if I start with an E left, I can either have here a Q left or a Q right. By the way, here you get, if I switch all the helicities, I'll get the same answer by parity conservation of the electromagnetic interaction. So the E minus right case is already taken care of here. Same thing here. These are massless particles, so there's helicity conservation. So the only thing in the final state is left and left right here. And then I just have to figure out which amplitude corresponds to which one and make the appropriate changes in the kinematic invariants. So if I cross this guy into the final state, it becomes the antiparticle, which is the E minus right. And if I cross this guy into the initial state, it becomes the Q left. So this is the quantity that applies to this one. Now, the thing in the denominator is going to be t, as you see. That's the momentum, that's the channel in which I have a singularity. What was here u, that is to say this minus that, this guy's come into the initial state, so that's actually s now. And for this one, what I'm going to do is to cross the Q that's fine. So S goes to T, U goes to S, and T must go to U. And my claim is that if you compute these quantities, that's what you're going to get. Okay. Well, now we're done. All I have to do is to take those things, sum them up, square them, and turn it into a total cross-section. And that's basically trivial. Yes? Sorry? Oh, sorry. I left it out. Thank you. Yes? Okay, so time always goes this way. The electron and the positron are going like that, and the arrows follow the fermion numbers. Okay, so these guys are going out, but this is an antiparticle. Okay. So now what I'm going to do is just distort this diagram by taking that leg and pulling it into the initial state. I wasn't consistent here. So I'm going to take this diagram, grab this, pull it around to the initial state, and grab that and pull it into the final state. And then I get this diagram. And that just causes this change of the invariance that U turns into S. S turns into T, which is obvious because that's where the singularity is. And then the last one is T has to turn into U. Okay, good. D sigma d cosine theta is given by the expression 1 over 2s. Anybody remember this? Okay, that's the formula that I asked you to memorize. Yes? I'm not hearing any shouts of recognition. This is the formula that I asked you to memorize, right? Okay. Let's square this. So it's 4e squared qf squared s squared over t squared. And very conveniently, e to the fourth. E to the fourth over 16 pi is pi alpha. So we get something like that's right. 2 pi alpha squared over s qf squared s squared over t squared. And if I include, now that's for a polarized. This is for the polarized case. If I include all four processes that I would have here, I would have 1/4 times 2, because the e minus right and the e minus left have the same cross sections. And I'd have to add u squared over t squared. And now I have the result for the unpolarized case. Okay, so 1/4 is the spin average in the initial state. 2 is because these are the calculations for E left and Q left, but if I look at E right, I'm going to get the same answers. But if I have E left, Q left, I get this, and if I have E left, Q right, I get that. And I think now everything is in place. And here's the final answer. D sigma d cosine theta is equal to pi alpha squared over s qf squared s squared plus t squared over u squared over t squared. And we're doing good. Now, cosine theta is not going to be the optimal integration variable now. So let's go back and remind ourselves that in the center of mass frame, in either of these scattering processes, t is equal to 1 minus 2 e squared cosine theta. So dt is equal to s over 2 d cosine theta. I'm leaving out minus signs in the measure. I hope that's OK. I thought it wasn't OK in one of the problem sets, but please excuse me. So I can write this equally well as d t here, with that factor of 2 has to come back, and an s squared, I think. And there we go. That's the final answer. D by dt is equal to 2 over s d by d cosine theta. OK. And t is a Lorentz invariant quantity. So this expression is a total cross-section valid in any frame. OK, well, now we're doing just fantastically well. We've calculated the basic process that I claim is going to go inside electron-proton scattering, namely the process of electron-quark scattering. By the way, if we had electron-anti-quark scattering, it would be the same answer. It's the same answer. An anti-quark is a fermion just as a quark is. You can check that. OK. Now the only question is, what does this calculation have to do with the electrons and the proton, with the quarks and the proton? So for that, we need to somehow model the proton. And I'd like to make what is absolutely the simplest and most naive model of the proton. What I'd like to say is the proton is just a big bag of quarks. You accelerate, well, the proton is sitting there in its rest frame. It's a little bag of its hydrogen, so it's a proton. I'm going to say the proton is just a bag of quarks. Maybe it's a little simpler to analyze the problem from the center of mass frame of the electron and the proton. And we're going to get the electron going really fast to really high energy. So in the center of mass frame, both of these things are both highly accelerated. So the picture I'd like to make is that the quarks inside the proton are bound by forces of order a GeV. Sorry. Oh, just temperature, yeah. OK. Whereas the whole proton is moving at, let's say, tens or hundreds of GeV. So the idealization that I'd like to make is that whatever's going on in here, what that does is just set up the wave function of the proton. But when the electron smacks the proton, it'll smack individual quarks. And all I need to know is what is the distribution of momenta of the quarks that get smacked. And further, because the binding energies in here, I'm going to say, are small compared to the energy of the electron, let me just ignore them. So I'm going to consider the proton as a bag from which quarks come out. So this momentum is p. This is what I call little p. I'm going to write little p is equal to xi times p, where xi is a number between 0 and 1. And I'm going to consider the distribution of xi's to be an unknown function for each type of quark, and later for anti-quarks and other things in the proton. And we'll just consider this to be made up from the wave function of the proton. The computation of that wave function is obviously a strong interaction problem that I can't ignore the strong interactions to compute that. So let me just take this as something I'm going to, for the moment, fit from experiment and analyze the rest of the problem according to this. Yes?
Sorry, what is capital P?
Well, capital P is the momentum of the proton. And little p is the momentum of the quark. And this model here is called the Parton model. It was originally introduced by Feynman. Feynman didn't mind being naive when it suited his purpose. And here it suited his purpose extremely well, as we'll see. OK. Well, now we're cooking. So now we have the following, please excuse me, very simplified model of electron-proton scattering. I'm going to go back to this orientation of the Feynman diagram now. We have the proton come in. We pick up a quark out of the proton. Everything else in the proton goes off in some other direction. That quark scatters from the electron. And it acquires a momentum p plus q. I'm going to totally ignore the strong interactions. And I'm going to work to lowest order in electromagnetism. And so this is the whole process. This thing here is described by this phenomenological function called the Parton distribution function, which depends on the wave function of the proton, which is hard to compute. But all this stuff, actually, we've already computed. And then Feynman realize something about this, which is extremely pretty, which is that technically this calculation involves an integral over the variable xi. We have to integrate over all the possible momenta that a given quark can have in the proton wave function. However, at this level of analysis, if we observe the electron in the final state, we can actually determine xi. And here's the argument. The momentum transfer, as I've said, is q. And given the setup of the experiment, we can measure Q as a four vector. The final momentum of the quark is P plus Q. By the way, I'm at high energy, so I'm ignoring all the masses of the quarks. In particular, this final quark is approximately massless. Well, it has a mass up to the mass of the proton. But if we're really high energy electron scattering, I'm just going to neglect that. So this is equal to zero. Now that's p squared plus 2p dot q plus q squared. This I'm also neglecting. This is p dot q. And this is minus q squared, I told you, which is a large positive number. Now, p is p times xi. And this quantity gets set equal to zero. So that's an easy equation to solve. Xi is equal to q squared over 2 capital P dot q. And so if I measure the properties of the outgoing electron, and in particular, I measure the q squared, and I also measure the q zero, the p dot q, which is basically the energy of the virtual photon in the rest frame of the proton, and I take the ratio, then according to this model, I'm scattering exactly from quarks with that momentum fraction. Yes?
So we're modeling the electron scattering off the proton as just the electron interacting with one of the quarks.
With one of the quarks in the proton.
Why is that okay? Why couldn't
it? I don't know why it's okay. I told you, this is very naive. Eventually, it's not going to be okay. But let's just see what it predicts, okay? Okay. Yes?
Can you tell me again why you're assuming p plus q squared is equal to zero?
Oh, because p plus q squared is the mass of this final quark. And that'll be 100 MeV or something like that. And I'm at very high energy. So I'm just ignoring it. So both this and this are of order of the mass of the proton. And I'm just assuming I'm at much higher energy than that for simplicity. OK, I could make this derivation a lot more complicated if I wanted to. OK. OK, well now, now we're really doing fantastically. Because now, if we can observe the momentum of this final electron, we can find out what the momentum of the quark is, again, assuming that the quark is exactly collinear with the proton, there's no transverse kick that comes from the structure of the proton wave function. It's just a softly bound array of quarks. And now I'm really in business. To complete the analysis, what I really need to do is to figure out now how to evaluate this expression. So the next order of business is to try and figure out how we calculate all the momentum invariants that are in this quantity. And so I think you can see how to get at them. Let's just try the following. So we have to calculate ST and U for this scattering process. Just for clarity, I'm going to call those S hat, T hat, and U hat. So S is 2k dot p, or maybe I should say s is k plus p squared, which is equal to 2k dot p if I ignore all the masses. And in this formula, what I have is the st and u for the electron quark scattering process, and I have to evaluate all those things. So first of all, s hat is k plus little p squared, so that's 2k dot p, if I ignore the masses, which is equal to xi times 2k dot p, which is equal to xi times s. Then t is the momentum transfer. And the momentum transfer, obviously, is q squared, so that's minus q squared. And then u, if I have all massless particles, U is just minus S minus T. So this is equal to 2k dot p times c minus q squared. Now, c is equal to q squared over 2p dot q. Well, sorry, I've kind of run out of room here. Two k dot p over two q dot p minus q squared. Sorry, and q squared minus q squared. So this is equal to 2k minus q dot p over 2q dot p. Oh, I'm sorry. I've gotten mixed up here. Let me just look at my notes and straighten myself out. Yeah, it would be good to have defined one more useful quantity. So let me start over. So this quantity, which is this is some fictitious quantity. This is a measurable quantity. It's called x. There's another quantity called y, which is 2p dot q over 2 p dot k. So y is, if I go to the rest frame, it's q0 over k0, which is to say the fraction of the electron's momentum that got transferred into the hadronic system. And very conveniently, both x and y are numbers that go between 0 and 1. So we have two kinematic variables, and there's a square. And we've now written the whole cross-section on that square. OK. Yes?
What is big Q?
Sorry, big Q? Big Q is defined by this equation. So the momentum transfer here is space-like. And so it's minus the square of a positive number. OK. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. So let me repeat this in just a moment. So this equation, the solution is that. So I just want to make a distinction. Psi is something in the model. But x, which is defined to be this ratio, is something you can measure. OK. And similarly, y, which is defined to be this ratio, is something you can measure. So now we have S hat is equal to 2k dot p is equal to x times S. T hat is minus q squared. And u hat is minus S. So, and by the way, q squared is given by the following expression. Q squared, you see, is x times y times s. That's the equation that I left out. If you multiply this times this, you get q squared over s. And so this is a correct equation. Now, u is minus s minus t. And that's equal to minus 1 minus y times x times s. Excellent. So now we're in just terribly good shape because we can actually evaluate every part of this formula in terms of observable quantities. And so now let me try and write down the answer. The integral d sigma is then given by the following expression. We can integrate over t, d sigma dt. Sorry. First of all, we have to integrate over xi. Then we have to sum over the various flavors of quarks and antiquarks that are in the proton. Each flavor has a parton distribution function f of xi. Then, for a given xi, we know what the momentum is coming in, and we know how to relate that to properties of the final state. Now we can integrate over dt and take the differential cross-section d sigma dt. And now let's just evaluate that. Two pi alpha squared over s squared, x squared s squared, because it's s hat, the quark charge squared, and then x times s squared plus x times s times 1 minus y squared divided by q squared squared. Okay. Well, now we're making fantastic progress. All I have to do is get rid of this derivative here. Can I erase this formula now? It's in the way. I've just evaluated it here. Sorry? The t became q squared. Sorry? No, t is q squared. Okay. Good. Okay, so now what can we do about the measure? This thing here is dx. Dt is q squared, which is xy ds. But basically, we already have a dx, so we can write that as dy times x times s. And now what we get is the differential cross-section as a function of the observable kinematic variables x and y. And here's the answer. It's got a 2 pi alpha squared. The s's here cancel. The leading x cancels. There's a q to the fourth here. There's this structure that comes from up here, 1 plus 1 minus y squared. And there's this power of s that gets left over. And there's a power of x that gets left over, which I'm going to put somewhere else. The sum over all the flavors in the proton, x f of x times q f squared, and we're done. Okay. How's that? You've got to admit that this is a very simple formula. The formula has the following very interesting property. Okay, first of all, x and y are kinematic variables that one can measure by measuring the properties of the final electron. So this formula is, in principle, something that can be matched to observations from the deep inelastic scattering experiment. The formula factorizes in a very beautiful way. This is pure QED. And this is a property of the wave function of the proton. The formula depends on two variables, x and y, or x and q squared. However, the part that contains the wave function of the proton doesn't depend on y. It only depends on x. And so the claim is that one can organize all of the deep inelastic scattering data by dividing by this known QED part. And then what you should get is a universal function of x that's the same whenever the value of x is the same, independent of other conditions of the experiment. So this property, which was, by the way, predicted before the Feynman picture, is called Bjerkane scaling. Actually, Bjerkane sometimes hangs around the Perimeter Institute.
He came a couple of months ago.
Yeah, so you guys should get a chance to meet him. He's quite an amazing fellow. Okay, how does it work? So are you all at this page in the PDF? And you can all see how complicated this data is and how it varies greatly And remember, in this experiment, remember the experiment is set up on the floor with this big spectrometer, and you can set the electron to various energies, and then you can rotate the spectrometer around and look at different angles. So you really get the whole two-dimensional picture of this cross-section in the measurements. Okay, now take the measurements, divide by this factor, and I've made a selection of the data. I'm only looking at data for which Q squared is above 1 GeV squared. And if you turn the page, you'll see it all falls onto a single curve. So this is just an amazing picture. Apparently, this naive picture organizes the data on deep and elastic scattering in a way that is, in fact, incredibly useful. And this factor that we've extracted is basically a picture of the wave function of the proton. It tells us, for example, in composites, how much momentum individual quarks in the proton have. What you would expect, I guess, is that a typical quark has about a third the momentum of the proton. That wouldn't actually be right, because if you remember, the proton, maybe it's a little too naive to say that the proton only contains quarks. You also need some field that sticks the quarks together, the so-called gluon field. So if I attribute half the momentum of the proton to the gluons and half to the quarks, and then I divide it in three, maybe a typical momentum is about a sixth of the momentum of the proton. And you can see that that's about the width of that function that you see. Okay. Well, now you can go ahead further and try to actually measure the momentum of the proton, measure all of these components. And then, in principle, you could devise a program to learn a lot about these individual parton wave functions. So let's talk a little about that. So now I'm going to take this parton model and take it even more seriously. So then these parton distribution functions, so this quantity f sub f of x is called the parton distribution function. It should obey some sum rules. It should obey the sum rule that the integral dx from 0 to 1 of everything, the sum of over flavors of f of x, should be 1. Because if I count up everything, that has the total momentum of the proton. So if I write this thing out more carefully, this is the integral dx fu of x plus fd of x plus fu bar of x plus fd bar of x plus the gluons plus whatever else is in the proton. That's a sum rule that this should sum up to 1. Similarly, if there are two up quarks in the proton, then I get this sum rule. And similarly, if there are two down quark, one down quark in the proton, then you get that sum. Of course, there's only so far you can go in just colliding electrons with protons. But fortunately, there are other... Yes?
How come those two equations follow?
This counts the number of net up quarks in the proton. And this counts the number of net down quarks in the proton. Okay. And then if you have strange quarks in the proton, that's fine too, as long as the number of strange quarks is equal to the number of anti-strange quarks, because you remember the proton has strangeness zero. Okay. So then we can do deep and elastic scattering on proton targets, on deuterium targets. So this is a proton plus a neutron. Now, for the neutron is the isospin partner of the proton. So you would just reverse the U and the D distributions. And so if I do these two experiments, I can somehow get U and D separately. And then there's some other experiments that we'll talk about next week that also allow you to access the individual quark components of the proton. Yes?
Sorry, why is that two?
Because there are two up quarks in a proton, two net up quarks in a proton. You can imagine that the proton has an up quark and then some extra up anti-up pairs. Yes?
That top integral should be 1, because wouldn't x be different for each different quark?
Yes, but if the up quarks have an average momentum of x up, and the down quarks have an average momentum of x down, and the gluons have an average momentum of x glue, these are all momentum fractions. If I add up all the momentum fractions, I should get the total momentum of the proton. So if I've accounted for everything, I should get 1. Right? The proton is just a composite of these components. So the components, if I have all of them, carry the total momentum of the proton.
I still don't see why x should be the same for all of them.
X is integrated over. From 0 to 1. Right? Any given particle can have any x between 0 and 1. And each type of particle, there's an average value of the x of that particle. So the average x for up quarks might be, the composite x for up quarks. Maybe the up quarks carry 2/3 of the momentum of the proton. The down quarks carry 1/4. The gluons carry what's left. That's what this equation says. Yes?
These three equations, when I write down here, you mean these are something tested by the experiment, or these are something derived from the previous?
Well, what I'm saying now is that these are additional constraints that you could put if you take this model seriously.
So
what you can do then is to gather a lot of data.
A proton has two up quarks in one.
Yeah. So this equation within the parton model follows from the fact that there are two up quarks in the proton. So you can use these equations to organize all of the data on electron-proton, electron-deuterium scattering. We'll talk next week about neutrino scattering from protons. In general, then, one can get a very concrete picture of what these parton distribution functions look like, that give you a kind of experimental picture of the proton wave function. And we'll talk next week a little more about how those things are determined in detail. Now, there are two more things I should tell you about this before we quit. The first is that you can ask what this looks like at higher energy. There's one more thing I should tell you before that. This structure here of 1 plus 1 minus y squared is also something that you can test in the experiment. See, this is the x dependence. Q squared is a trivial factor. That's obviously there. There's also some characteristic y dependence. This characteristic y dependence comes from the helicity structure of electron fermion scattering. So I'd like to just remind you that the 1 here comes from electron left-handed quark going to electron left-handed quark scattering. And the 1 minus y comes from electron right-handed quark going to electron right-handed quark scattering. Why is there a suppression at high y? Well, high y is when the electron transfers all of its momentum to the quark, right? When y goes to 1, you have all of the momentum of the electron being transferred to the quark. But if you write the helicities here, there's helicity conservation, the angular momenta don't match. So this has to vanish at y equals 1. And we'll see that coming into the phenomenology in some of the things we discussed next week. This structure 1 plus 1 minus y squared is actually one of the original pieces of evidence that quarks are spin a half. You get that factor for spin a half, you would get a different factor for spin 0 or higher spin quark components. Okay, now the next question is what happens when you do this at higher energy? So these original slack experiments were done with a maximum energy of protons fixed and electrons coming in at 17 GeV. But of course, over the years, those energies have gotten higher. One of the most interesting set of deep inelastic scattering experiments, which I'll tell you a little about next week, are the neutrino nucleon deep inelastic scattering experiments done at Fermilab and then at CERN with neutrino energies of hundreds of GeV. Most recently, at the German accelerator HERA, this is a facility with, I think, something like 800 GeV protons colliding with, if I remember correctly, 50, I don't remember these numbers, unfortunately. It's something like 800 GeV protons on 50 GeV electrons and positrons. And so then you have a colliding beam set up. You can get much higher energies. You can get momentum transfers that are of the order of hundreds of GeV. And I'll give you one little snapshot of this HERA program. It's in the next PDF in this set. Here, the X range is extended way down to 10 to the minus 4. And as you see, that the parton distribution just keeps going up. So there are more and more quarks in the proton when you look at very small momentum fractions. And because of these sum rules, presumably what that is more and more quark-antiquark pairs that fill in a more detailed structure of the proton. So the proton is three quarks plus gluons plus lots of quark-antiquark pairs, and more as you go to very small momentum fractions. Feynman anticipated this and called these guys the wee partons. But they are an important part of the structure. We have to explain where they come from, and for that we really will need a theory of the strong interactions. And finally, on the last page, what I have is a picture of a typical event from HERA. So what's going on in this picture is you have the very high energy proton coming in from, I think it's this side in your orientation. The electron is coming in from this side. The electron backscatters. So at the top of the picture, you can see a single track and a hit in the electromagnetic calorimeter. And that's the backscattered electron. And then at the bottom of the slide, what you see is a jet. And we know from E plus E minus annihilation that a jet is the signal of a quark. So in these events, you can really visualize exactly what's going on in this reaction. This thing is the thing you see on the top, the electron. And this thing turns into a jet, which is visible as a distinct jet in the bottom part of the slide. So this parton stuff, it's really right. And maybe we should take this as a starting point now to think about how the strong interactions could work. Now, the strong interactions now are, I think this really adds to their weirdness. They're definitely strong because quarks don't get out. They're strong, we know that they're strong because they make all these bound states, a whole spectrum of hadronic bound states. But on the other hand, when we have a very hard scattering process, we can apparently ignore their effects. And how is that possible? Well, it turns out to be possible because of a peculiar property of quantum field theory. And so that's the thing that I will explain to you when we come back on Monday. Okay? I wanted to just say one more thing. If you're going through the lecture notes, you'll notice that I skipped a lecture, which was the one last year scheduled for Thursday. And that was the one about the quark-antiquark bound states of heavy quarks. So if you're in doubt about the reality of quarks, you might want to read that lecture. lecture too. There's lots of other interesting material that I want to talk to. Okay, we're done. See you on Monday.